Hello. When your mind is... Hello again, Charles.
And good evening to our very special guest who's currently connecting to audio. But our special guest, just to introduce our special guest, York musician Chris Helm. One of the most long-standing of all York musicians. And Chris has had, in more recent times, solo career, and before that, the Yards. And, of course, the reason for us getting together this evening is the Seahorses, the band that was formed with John Squire as he left Stone Roses and with fellow York musician Stuart Fletcher. And led to the release of an album that made number two in 1997, recorded for Geffen Records in Northern California. And that album, Do It Yourself, I think it was called, unless you can correct me on that, Graham.
They were a big rock band.
Absolutely. Here is the familiar face, no less, of Chris Helm. We can say, welcome, Chris, and good
Hello.
Evening.
We're
just on the big build-up for you, so you didn't have to embarrass yourself by hearing us enthuse about the past. But just okay. The reason for us getting together tonight, Graham and Chris, is because we bumped into Chris last year mentioning the 25th anniversary would be falling of the Seahorses, as it turned out, one and only album. We'll come on to that story as well, of course. Quite rightly, Chris pointed that out to us and said, I think it'd be a good one for the podcast. Now, lo and behold, suddenly there was a reminder of this because Chris is playing at the wonderful Pocklington Arts Centre on Saturday night, I think it is, Chris, isn't it? Saturday night?
That's right, yeah.
And this is going to be a solo acoustic performance of the songs from Do It Yourself. And it is literally Do It Yourself because obviously you're on your own. And it's solo and acoustic, and no surprises that John Squire won't be with you.
No, of course not.
Can't you give him an easy question?
Why is it, Charles, I can just see the top of your head?
Okay, well, it's a glorious top there. A bit more now, coming into focus.
It's his best feature.
There you go.
The top, the shiny top, the dome of the head. So, Chris, I guess... I mean, you could have ignored the 25th anniversary of the Seahorses. Chat to Tim Hornsby, and he would always point out, in some ways in the past, you would not want to push the Seahorses connection, and I kind of understand that. But actually, you know, 25 years on, it entirely makes sense to revisit it and think about it. And so let's look at that first, the thought of re-looking at it, and we'll then come on to how it all came about in the first place.
Okay, well... I wasn't going to do it this year. I've basically been mixing my album and I was going to release my album this year. And then I was doing a project with Mark Morris from the Blue Tones and Nigel Clark from Dodgy. And that was called MCH. So this year was pretty much plotted out for doing all of that.
Mm.
And then that didn't happen for one reason or another. And... I basically just thought, well, I put my album on hold because I was going to dedicate it this year to the MCH project.
Yeah.
And obviously that didn't happen. So it was like, right, well, I need to do something. So my agent was like, well, how about doing the 25th anniversary? Because I was going to do it on the 30th anniversary. Yes. But the way the world's been going, I don't think that we might not be here for the 30th one. So I decided to kind of do it. And I wasn't particularly going to do that many, but then I was very quite reticent I'll do a couple of shows and see how it goes. I remember the first one was like a warm up in Bridlington Spa, and they've got a new room in Bridlington Spa, and it's kind of like really great acoustics and great sound. Mm. And I went there and I practiced the songs. I'd not played most of the songs for 20 odd years, really. Some of them I avoided because I knew that they probably might not work acoustically. Yeah. But then I thought to myself, well, I've made the others work, so I might as well give this the same treatment. And I did the gig. And I thought, well, that was okay. And then the next one was Stockton about 2 weeks later, the Ark in Stockton.
Oh, yes.
And I was quite nervous. It's all seated. It sold out. And I was thinking, right, okay, I'll have to... I remember getting there at 4 o'clock to soundcheck. And I remember soundchecking, and I played through the set about 8 times until it was like 7 o'clock before the doors. And I stayed on stage for the entire time just to make sure that my muscle memory was there. And then as soon as I was quite really nervous, I remember actually shaking backstage. And I quickly necked a glass of wine, got on stage, and everyone was there. The whole place was packed out. There was such a great crowd in Stockton as well, and they were very welcoming. And then I got on stage and started chatting, which is something that I do, but I would never have done that in the Seahorses, weirdly. and I realised that I had a lot of stories to tell about the songs. So and one of the jokes is that the album only lasts 40 minutes, but a lot of my gigs are like for an hour and 15 minutes. So I do pad it out with a lot of twaddle. And but it is interesting, really, because, I mean, I get asked a lot of questions about stuff. I mean, I was exceptionally lucky to join the Seahorses. I was thinking, considering about even packing music in at one point, and then I went
busking. Chris, why not tell that story? Because it is, in its own way, I mean, it's the very definition of serendipity in some ways. If I say the words York, busking, and someone heard you, that's the starting point, but let's have your version of what happened.
Well, my version, the real version, there is only one version in this. I was basically, I had my guitar, I had £20 in my back pocket. I wanted to go see my parents who live in Oswaldwick. And in the 90s, the bus services weren't great and the bus drivers were even worse. In the sense that they were totally and utterly would not let you on a bus if you didn't have the exact change or something near it.
Oh, yes.
And I had 20 quid. So I thought, well, they're not going to break that. So I'll just busk for a little bit. Maybe I think it was 50p to get from centre of town to Oswaldwick. So I was like, right, I'll just make 50p. That's all I need to make. And then I'm going to go off and go see my mum and dad. And so I did. And I was walking past Woolworths and I realised that... I thought, oh, actually, you could busk outside of here. No one busks outside of here.
No.
So it wasn't your usual spot. And it was a Sunday afternoon. And a guy called Dennis and his family walked past. He sadly passed away, as Dennis, bless him. But if it wasn't for him walking past that day, I would never have known what was to come after, really. And, Dennis was like, oh, you look like... I think he said something like, you look the part, you look like you could be a singer in a band. My mate's just left a band and he's a really big band and he's setting up this other band. And I just said, is it John Squire? And he was like, how did you know that? And I was like, well, York's really small and Stuart Fletcher's already been asked to join his band. So it doesn't take a genius to figure it out. So I remember him asking for my... Well, I didn't have a mobile phone or anything then. He asked me if I had a tape. If you were a busker and you had CDs, it meant that you had too much money and you didn't
need exactly
the kind of a thing there. And he said I needed to put a tape and get a tape together. And he gave me his telephone number and then and put a photograph in there. And I didn't have any photos. So I remember having to go to the train station to go into a photo booth and have my photo taken. And I realised later that I was one of many people, because John had put an advert in the paper in the NME saying that he was looking for a singer and a drummer and a bass player, but he'd already found his bass player by this point. I was one of many, but I think it got to the top of the pile, mainly due to Stu Fletcher kind of putting in a good word for me. And I knew Martin, who was John's guitar tech as well.
Yeah.
And he kind of been to see me a few times and he put a good word in. It all kind of happened. But John said that I had a fat neck. I nearly didn't get into the band because my neck was too fat.
Neck?
Yeah, bull neck, I think he called me. Bull necked Yorkshireman. And then I kind of did this few gigs with John. John came to Fibbers. I got exceptionally drunk. I was dreadful. I think Tim's got that on video somewhere, that gig. I think I ended up with like two strings left on my acoustic guitar at that point. And then I think I kind of cooked my goose. I was quite annoying that night. I think I even annoyed myself, which takes some doing. And then John came to a few other gigs a few weeks later and asked me to play in Manchester. And then I remember I was asked to do another gig, which was supporting the girl from the Beautiful South, whose name escapes me now. And it was a big gig. I think it was at the Apollo in Manchester.
Brianna Corrigan?
Maybe.
The first of their singers?
I blocked it out of my mind because I never did the gig. I remember I was going out with Heather Finlay at the time and we were having an argument and I turned my back on her and folded my arms and she pushed me onto the bed and I landed on my head and got whiplash.
On your bull neck. on your
on my bull neck. Yeah. So I ended up having to wear a neck brace, which I said to Simon Moran, who was the promoter and ended up being our manager, I can't do this gig. I'm so sorry. My girlfriend's pushed me up the bed and fucking my neck up. So I had a neck brace on for like 3 weeks. I didn't do that gig. But then it didn't really matter. By this point, I was rehearsing with John anyway, and it was went to his house in Lancaster. And then we, me, Stu and John just did loads and loads of working through his songs. And then he heard Blinded by the Sun, which I'd written when I lived in Brighton the summer before. And then, he really liked it. And then he asked me if I had any more songs. And I was like, yeah, I've got a few. So it was very generous of him to actually include my songs on the album, which was really nice. So that was that, really. But it's much down to Dennis, really. I remember when the record company were saying, have you got any stories? When we were doing the press, they wanted to see if I had any interesting stories, like, have I ever been in jail? Do I have a drug habit? You know, it was Geffen Records, so the last band that they were dealing with was Nirvana.
Nirvana, wasn't it? Yes.
So I was with their press agent, Bryn, and I remember just not having any. I was like, not really, nothing of interest. I said, I used to be a busker. And they were like, a busker? What's a busker? And I was like, well, it's where you go and play on the streets, like you have a guitar and you sing songs and people throw money at you. And she was like, wow, how Dickensian. Like, is it like Oliver? Like you were street urchin and you were begging? And I was like, no, I wasn't. I was playing music and people were throwing money. And I learned how to play more than two chords when I was busking, actually. And anyway, she embellished it and said that John had walked past and seen me and threw me some money. And then it was all this bullshit. And I just remember thinking, fucking hell, is this how it's going to go on?
Exactly.
I kind of, I remember if I get asked every gig, for every single gig I've done since, the question is it true John Squire found you busking outside of Woolworths? And if I had a penny, in fact, I do actually charge a pound now to answer that one.
I didn't quite give that version. I got the confused version in which Martin was the one that picked up a cassette from you and gave it to John. So I've got a rubbish version as well then, you see. So.
Well, I think that Dennis will have passed the tape on to Martin. So I guess.
That was always the version that I spun. Graham,
I guess
question
that's how
from
it got
you.
To the top of the pile, really.
Yeah, well, it's great to see Chris again. It's Hello. Also great to see you're still looking good, Chris, because I watched the videos for Blinded by the Sun and Love is the Law today. And my God, you look like some sort of like prepubescent version of Jim Morrison. So like really good looking.
Hey.
And really slim and really young. And
prepubescent version of Jim Morrison. My goodness.
Yeah. Well, I can see why you got the game. You've got old John Squire, who's now a veteran, playing all these big, heavy sub-Led Zeppelin blues rock riffs. And that's balanced by you with a sort of like choir boy voice. In young, good looks, and it makes a great balance when you see it now. So you can understand why it worked at the time.
I think I had a bit of body dysmorphia going on back then because it must have stuck with me. I was always on a diet all the time. I think we were kind of starved in a way because there was this thing called indie skinny, and because you were going to be on TV a lot and having your picture taken a lot, it was encouraged to basically have one meal a day. And I remember being about 10 stone and my jean size was 29, 33 or something. And I can't even get that past my ankles now.
Do you remember Tiny from Ultrasound?
Ultrasound, is that a band or was it a?
Yeah, they were nearly big during the Britpop boom, and he was famed for actually being properly fat. That was his like his calling
card.
Was
he from Leeds?
It might have been. Richard Green played guitar for him, who was from Leeds.
I think he was in another band, and he used to just stuff cake and throw cake at the audience, I remember. I think I do know what you mean. Yeah.
You're probably right.
He was really great. He had a great sense of humour, and then he joined Ultrasound and became indie serious. And it was like, oh no, this is what I've seen. Yeah, I do remember him. He was a nice guy, then. Yeah, I met loads. I saw him at the Spotted Cow. They were really good. We had to look the part, I guess. And I used to think that because I was comparing myself with, you know, the people like Brett Anderson or Jarvis Cocker, who were all like these kind of waif modelly type people. And I look dreadful in smart clothes and they look amazing in smart clothes. You know, I look like, I just, the more I get dressed up, the more I look like a scallywag. It's just weird. So, I've kind
the
of
Artful Dodger. That's you. Yeah,
yeah, probably.
So, because the album...
Ironically, you did look good. In all the photographs and videos, you look good.
Well, I wish I looked like that now.
So the album, Chris, you made the album in Northern California. I think that's right.
In Hollywood,
In Hollywood. So how was that as an experience?
It was great. I mean, I'd never made an album before. I'd done demos with the band Chugspa that I was in before. And then I recorded a bunch of songs with Mark Atkinson, actually, in his studio. And then I did some stuff with Red Submarine, which was Andy Woss, who owns Gear for Music now. And he recorded me. And all of these were from busking, really. I think he'd seen me busking and like what I did, so... So that was the extent of recording for me. I didn't understand what a producer was. I couldn't believe how expensive studios were. And then people told me the history of, you know, microphones and all that. And as boringly enough, as years go by, I've ended up becoming a bit of a kind of gear freak when it comes to studio stuff. And I've got far more microphones than I care to mention now. But it was interesting. And I wish that I'd asked more questions when I was making the album. But back onto it, Tony Visconti, his name came up, and I was like, who's he? And I said, no, he should do the... And he was like, he should do the album. And I'm like, what do you mean, do the album? He's like, produce it. And I was like, what do you mean, produce it? What does that mean? What does a producer do? And they were like, well, you know, like George Martin in the Beatles? Mm. And I was like, yeah. And he says, well, it's like what he does. And I was like, what does he do? Absolutely no idea. They were like, well, yeah, it's Tony Visconti. He did David Bowie and produced T-Rex and Blood, Sweat and Tears and all this other stuff. Thin Lizzy. And I was like, oh, okay. And then John said, it's kind of like a film director. You know, if you basically give a script to a bunch of actors and then they just do whatever they want, it's going to be a bit shit. The producer keeps you in line. He makes you play because you want to impress him. Tony Visconti is a pretty impressive guy. Look at his back catalogue. And then it all made sense. And then I remember him being pretty much the same age as my dad. So when I met Tony, he was absolutely lovely. Really gracious guy. He definitely lived a life and, you know, was still doing it. And he was very organised and very knowledgeable. And he got the best performances out of all of us, I think. At that time, anyway.
Did he have much input into the actual sound? Did he have much input into the sound? Because the album sounds like a cross between Love Spreads' album, I Love the Second Coming album, the Second Stories album, and a bit more sort of your sort of poppy, slightly folky feel to it. And it doesn't sound like a Tony Visconti album.
No, not really. It was, there wasn't a great, if you listen to the acoustic guitars on that album, they're not very loud. There's about 18 tracks of John's guitars on a lot of things. Yeah. So that might be the sort of Second Coming kind of thing that you mentioned.
But
mainly there was a lot of strings on there. I think I mean, Tony's a real blender, really. It wasn't just Tony who worked on the album either. It's a guy called Rob Jacobs who produced U2's Rattle and Hum, I think it was.
Yeah.
Or he worked on it. I'm not sure if he produced it or he engineered it.
Mm.
And he did the Blood, Hell Freezes Over, the Eagles live album. He did that one as well. So, and he was well respected as well, but he was half the age of Tony. So them two used to argue all the time because Tony used to accuse Rob Jacobs of thinking that he'd invented the Valve preamplifier and things. And yeah, there was a bit of tension there. But generally speaking, it was really good. I think we all tried to play to our best abilities, and we didn't want to piss Tony off because he didn't put up with any shit. But at the same time, he was really amazing. Such a great guy. The best bit was when he did the string section for Blinded by the Sun, and he said to me, "Come in here, Chris." And he went into the live room, and there was the orchestra, which was, we borrowed from Barbara Streisand, who was they had a day off, and from working with Barbara Streisand, it was the LA Philharmonic, I think it was. So they were in the live room, and I remember sitting on a flight case, and he said, "Don't make a sound because we're recording this." He said, "But this will blow your mind." And I sat there, and I couldn't really hear the backing track apart from the tinniness from maybe a couple of headphones, but mainly it was just the strings and in this amazing orchestra, and it was fantastic. And he was conducting it, and he'd written all the parts. And I mean, I just sat there and I was going, I cannot believe that a year ago I was in a bedsit in Brighton with the window painted open when I'd written the song Blinded by the Sun.
Yeah.
You know, and thinking to myself, I didn't ever think that it would ever be heard by anyone, never mind be produced by this guy. So yeah, it was a bit of a mind-blowing moment, that.
And lo and behold, a number three single and a number two album.
Yeah.
I mean, that level was, you know, short of falling, you know, just falling short of number one. That's a remarkable level to be at. And as you say, from being in a Brighton bedsit to that, was quite something to take in. Working with Tony Visconti, working with an orchestra that's used to working with Barbara Streisand, all these things are extraordinary. Then all the performances that have to go with it, on the usual way of having to be on what, Top of the Pops or whatever. And then it came to, I think you would have performed as the Seahorses, of course. You would have toured. So was there a real sense of it almost going out of control at that stage? Or was it all very organized and very switched on and actually as it was supposed to be to plan at that time?
I think the main thing that I realized very quickly was there were people in place that made things happen very quickly.
Mm.
And as long as you knew what you were doing on stage and, you know, as long as you were to the best of your ability rehearsed up and, you know, you get on with it, you do it, then that's all I could do. Try not to eat too many bacon sandwiches and basically turn up and, yeah, I mean, that was it. And I did that for two years, maybe 2.5 years. I don't know how long it lasted, to be fair. It was all a massive whirlwind. But I do remember in some ways feeling prepared, but it wasn't enough.
No.
Because you've got the variables of festival sound engineers and not sound checking at a festival and the excruciating volume of everything. I went from playing in little pubs and stuff, you know, with chilts bar and things, and then busking on the streets of York unamplified, to playing on Glastonbury stage, on the NME stage that was sinking in the mud, with no sound check, and I couldn't hear anything but white noise for the entire set. I could basically hear the first few notes that John would play on the guitar, and I had to pitch from that for the entire
song. Your sheer stadium equivalent, yeah.
Oh, it was awful. And it was the first time we were properly on TV live as well.
So exactly, like,
I wanted it to be amazing, and it was very far from it. And it took me 17 and a half years for me to watch the video footage back.
It's how did it feel when you did, Chris? How did it feel?
Well, I had to get very drunk so I could deal with it and have the level of kind of disassociation from it.
Yeah.
and I wasn't as bad as I thought. I think I managed to stay as in tune as anyone could, but you've got to bear in mind, it's a lot of John's songs. They've got mad key changes in, and you know, you're thinking, Jesus, it's absolutely, I had to do it all from muscle memory in my throat. It was weird. And I felt kind of, and it was always like that. And for the entirety of the Seahorses, it was always too loud. And I that was one thing that I found really spoiled fun for me, because I couldn't hear anything I was doing. And you've got all these people jumping around in front of you, and all you want to do is do a good job. And it was just too loud. I mean, now you'd have in-ears and stuff, and you'd have, you know, a lot of technology, which would probably make it a lot easier. But back then, I've got permanent tinnitus now because of it as well. Which is a bit annoying. Just but there like, you go. But it wasn't all misery. I mean, that was the kind of thing that it was sort of put dampeners on it a little bit, but it was amazing. But we were traveling around all the time. So from one country to the next, we honestly, I mean, it's a bit cliche, but you do just see the inside of hotels and aeroplanes and vans. And that is it. But it was good
for Graham, your question.
Yeah, I got a couple of points. When I did publish my little music magazine, Charm, in the late 90s,
I remember.
In Harrogate, Leeds and York, and I wrote a lot about Seahorses. I interviewed Stuart Fletcher, and I think I interviewed you as well. And my great friend Chris Wilson auditioned to be the drummer in Seahorses that cut in the Lake District, and he didn't get picked, but he remembers being there. He remembers most of it. When John wasn't involved with the music, his main interest seemed to be playing computer games, and that seemed to be about it. And I thought, that's quite a contrast. That's quite a contrast to Stuart Fletcher, as I know, because when I used to drink a lot, I could behave slightly crazily, as indeed could Stu. So he once invited me out to go and see Love with him, and I didn't go because I figured he was much more crazy than I was. And I thought, well, if John Squire's idea of fun is a computer game, and Stuart Fletcher's idea of fun is definitely not a computer game, this is a strange mix of people to be in a successful band together.
I think it's called individualism. and we can, everyone's different, but I don't remember John playing many computer games. I remember he was into Tomb Raider, I remember. He wrote a song, which was absolutely dreadful, for the second album, which is one of the reasons why the band split up, because I refused
to come on to that, Chris, shortly, if we may. Mm-hmm. Graham, your second point you're going to make?
Well, I was going to say that most rags to riches stories aren't true, but in Chris's case, it is largely true. So
it's not true. I beg to differ. I was wearing a really rather nice, tidy pair of jeans, and I don't believe there's any rat involved.
<no. laughs> Well, you can be poor and have style, Chris.
I still have, apparently. But this is it. I had like two jobs. It was hilarious. It was kind of like you go and sign on, and then I'd go work cashing, and I shouldn't be saying this. It was in the 90s, so I'm sure no one's going to bat an eyelid. I wasn't the only one. And I'd go and work in a shop selling vintage clothes in the Stonegate Yard, which doesn't exist anymore. The shop was called Ragamuffin. And then I'd go busking. And, and the people that I'd signed on with from the job centre would go past and drop me a quid, you know, so or a pasty or whatever. So it was like, everyone knew I was born, but I was skinned, but I wasn't, you know, poor. But at this end of the day, it definitely, we didn't get paid proper money until we'd been in the band for about a year, to be honest.
Yeah, really? Yeah.
I was going to say, did you actually get any riches from the success?
I did all right out of it. Yeah, we all did.
That's good. Because you wrote Blinded by the Sun. That was number 7 in the charts. I mean, Blinded by the Sun was one of the main reasons that the album sold so well, because it's a great track.
Do you think? I thought Love Is So... You see, this is the thing, because I'd just cracked on. I had no control over whether that was going to be a single or not. I remember when they were asking us what do you think are going to be the singles, and John said, I don't want to get involved in that. Just let the record company decide, because I think it had previously caused a lot of arguments with the Stone Roses and stuff. Whoever writes the song gets the publishing royalties from, you know, the airplay and everything. And you can accumulate quite a lot of money very quickly if you're getting airlisted on Radio 1 or whatever back then. So that kind of, for you to try and force your point with your song was really not the done thing, I don't think. But they did choose Blinded by the Sun, and I do remember being very chuffed about that. I wasn't expecting it to happen again.
There's a Noel Gallagher song on there as well, isn't there? Now, what's the story behind that?
It's a Liam Gallagher song.
Oh, it's a Liam Gallagher. Oh, yeah, I'm so sorry.
Makes it even more of an anomaly.
Yeah, not quite as good.
That does make it an anomaly. It's a Liam Gallagher song.
Right. Yeah. It's called Love Me and Leave Me.
Love Me and Leave Me.
The story is that I remember John playing the chords, and he told me that what the lyrics were, but he'd never really recorded it. And he told me what the melody was as well. And I was like, oh, this is really good. I love the chords and I love the lyrics. And I think it's really quite a beautiful song. And he said, oh, I wrote this with Liam at the weekend. And I was like, oh. And he said, yeah, we went to the football, or we were watching the football at Liam's flat or whatever. Might have been at John's, I don't know. And then he said that they were both hammered, and Liam started singing Love Me and Leave Me, which is the chorus over those chords. And that was that. But when Liam was asked about this, he couldn't remember anything about it. but then weirdly, it was the anniversary of Nebworth, and I think John came up and played guitar for him again at Nebworth. So instead of Oasis doing it was Liam doing it, and I think it was Solly.
Yeah.
And John came up and played. He was the guest guitarist on some stuff. And I think Liam had mentioned in an interview that suddenly his recollection of it all came flooding back. He hadn't written it. But there was a bit of a bone of contention because Liam got 50% of the publishing for that song.
Yes.
And John was definitely not up for sharing his publishing with us.
No.
Stuart finished a lot of John's songs off.
Yeah.
The whole ending of Love is the Law wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for Stuart.
Yeah.
And you could say that about a lot of things in that album. And John wouldn't give him a penny for
it.
So there seemed to be a bit of a double standard there. And my mate Stuart managed to get through it without...
Yeah.
I think probably Liam could afford bigger lawyers than Stuart.
Yes.
I don't think Liam needed lawyers. It wasn't anything like that. It was nothing to do with Liam. It's just the fact that John seemed to kind of like not be happy to share it with certain people and not others. And it's just
it
was kind of telling about someone's personality, that really. But there you go. That's when we started to think, this is about money for certain people. And we were just happy to be involved in it.
Sure. So it comes to the Love Me or Leave Me moment. And I mean, the band came together in maybe unusual circumstances, if you like. You know, it's not like a pop idol band being put together, but, you know, it was an interesting way that it came together. But the stresses and strains when it came to the second album, and I remember bumping into you and, you know, and you saying what had happened and whatever. So just talk us through that moment when you realized this is not going to happen. This is just going to stop.
Sorry, could you repeat that? I missed the gist of this.
The when you became aware that the second album was just not going to happen, in the case of Suede, they actually managed to make the second album despite falling out. But in your case, Chris, it didn't get that far.
Well, we'd recorded bits of it. I remember it's out there. It's a bootleg. I get asked a lot about this album, it's become a bit of a cult classic, really, for some of the fans of John and the Seahorses and Stone Roses people as well, because obviously John's on it. But I remember not being happy with the way it was, where it was going. We were supporting bands like the Rolling Stones, and you know, we supported U2, and we were playing these new songs, and I realised that there was no... For me, I just wasn't getting any emotional depth from it. I felt like I couldn't lose myself in it. I didn't know what he was on about. He changed the lyrics like every 10 minutes on some songs, and some songs needed to be changed. But other songs, I was just thinking, well, this doesn't mean anything. And it all seemed a little bit like it was all kind of a bit like a platform for playing a lot of kind of complicated guitar stuff, which bedroom guitarists that absolutely love. Whereas for me, it was like, well, as a singer, I kind of was in a position to, and on big stages, to be thinking, well, I should be doing what I want to be doing. Because this doesn't last forever. No. And I felt like I'd just gone on the wrong path with it all. And then when I started to try and introduce my songs, he wasn't interested. I think there was a couple on there which we managed to squeeze on, but it was sort of he just seemed all very one-sided, and I felt like John kind of knew it was the end of the road, really. It was around about the time where the record companies were getting taken over by Seagram's, the whiskey company. There was a big monopolist commission thing investigating all of that at the time. And everything sort of got consolidated under one umbrella. And a lot of A&R men got fired, and a lot of people were very nervous in record companies. And I think there was a high chance that bands that didn't hit the targets were basically going to get dropped, included us. And I think John knew this. Yes. So he was basically a bit of a kind of a cash grab before it all ended. And I think he wanted to have the album out and then get the publishing deal, which would be massively in his favour, and then he would have split the band up anyway. So mid-recording, I decided to dig my heels in. I didn't like singing a lot of the songs. There's one particular song which I mentioned earlier, Tomb Red.
That's quite a thing to do, is to decide no.
There was a lot of things in motion. There was a lot of things where I felt very on my own at that point. There were certain things that people did that they all did together, and I wasn't involved in that. You know, kind of drug things.
Yeah.
And it just didn't work for me in that sense. And I didn't need it, more to the point.
No.
I think I was drinking too much, and I realized I was kind of going the wrong way, really, with everything, dealing with it in the wrong way. And you know, looking back on it now, it's like I'm amazed I got through it, really. There was a lot of pressure. I just basically got my head down, did everything I thought I was supposed to do. It was just, the whole people following you around town and stuff, and that side of it, I wasn't used to that. I didn't become a musician for any of that. I wanted to be good at something. And I wanted to do something that I enjoyed. I wasn't expecting all that horrid things that come with fame and things like that. And it was quite sort of, the people that I was with in a band, like the management and stuff like that, I realised that we were just a commodity, really, at the end of the day. And I managed, and because of what was going on with the whole Seagram's takeover and the way that the record company had changed. And I remember speaking to one guy who was head of the Universal, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And we were just on a number on a spreadsheet to him.
Yeah.
Simon Moran asked me to go and try and sweet talk him, and I didn't even know what to say to him. I didn't even really know who he was or what he did.
No.
And he made us feel like crap. I remember just thinking, well, what a horrible business to be in.
You saw the other side of the business. Icarus flying too close to the sun is probably not an image actually that's right there, because that wasn't the case. It wasn't recklessness on your behalf or whatever. This was something, you know, where you felt there was a loss of control that was happening, and that must be difficult when that's happening, and it's not, you know, and it's not you that's you know, that in any way is part of that, you know, that's why that's happening. No matter what you did, you weren't able to stabilize things.
This is the thing that always kind of consoles me in a way when I kind of get a little bit sort of down about it. And even 20 odd years later, sometimes I do a bit because I'm only human.
Yeah.
But I do count my lucky stars that I'm still around. It didn't continue.
No.
And I put my foot down at the time where I thought I needed to. And I don't think anyone's really ever said no to John, and he didn't particularly take well to it. No. I looked at the contract, and if I'd have left the band, I'd have been liable for £1 million or $1 million to pay for the cost of the album that never got finished. Personally liable for that. And then I realized that I was feeling a bit upset about things that were going on in my personal life. And
yes, yes.
Really, I think the word depression was not bandied around as much as it is now.
No.
I remember telling my car manager that I was feeling a bit like that. And he said, either man up or hurry up and kill yourself because we'll sell more records. And there was no irony in his tone.
Terrible.
I was like, right, this isn't working. And it basically felt like I was just making money for a lot of other people and they didn't give a fuck about the consequences, really.
Exactly.
And that was a good lesson to learn, to be fair, because if that's happening and I'm around people like that, I basically just sack it off. I have no problem about walking away, no matter how much money I was making or anything like that. Mm. I had a lot of friends saying, just stick with it. You'll be making another album and stuff. Mm. And I could just see where it was going. And I was like, absolutely not. I cannot do this.
In terms of being, that possibility of a million pounds, lawsuit or whatever that would have happened, how was that avoided then, Chris?
I dug my heels in recording studios, got exceptionally drunk and made a complete ass of myself and was particularly obstructive when it came to singing songs that I didn't like.
Mm.
But it got unbearable for John and he actually split the band up.
So that's the thing of in a divorce, with the unreasonable behaviour, who actually decides that doing the unreasonable behaviour. But in the end, you did the unreasonable behaviour bit.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much it. But it was in an extreme way because I could have done worse, but really all I needed to do was just be a little bit disobedient and that would have been enough.
Yeah.
I'd been doing exactly as I was told for years. And then when I started to question it, that's when I realized who I was with, and it was like, oh, this isn't somewhere I want to be.
So there will be no Seahorses reunion then?
I doubt it. Not after this interview.
Yeah, this is the one that finally finishes us on. Just last thing to ask, I suppose, is now that you're revisiting those songs and you're revisiting them in a different way, obviously in the acoustic way or whatever. But how you sort of reassess those songs a quarter of a century on?
Well, it's interesting because the songs back then, because I would basically get your head down, keep on going, keep doing it. Mm. The lot of the kind of sentiments, because there was a lot of noise. And when you break it down to just the guitar and the lyrics, and then you think, right, there's a definite way of singing this. So I embellish it my own way now. And that can kind of create a completely different feel a lot of the times. So if, for instance, there's a song called Love Me and Leave Me, which we talked about.
Yeah.
I remember I used to do that acoustically because I always thought it was kind of just didn't really work. And then these days now I've kind of thought, how would someone like Chet Baker do it or Billie Holiday or something?
Mm.
Because it's got jazzy chords in it. And I was just thinking, we could make this work actually. Mm. And I mean, I don't do an impression of Chet Baker or Billie Holiday, but it definitely helps with the feel of it. And then all of a sudden, the narrative becomes a lot stronger. You start kind of like really getting absorbed in it immersed in it, And it's been an absolute joy, if I'm honest. I really didn't want to kind of do this for long, but I'm really enjoying it now. Mm. I think I've had a word with myself really with it and I'm really enjoying it. And it's nice to be able to do that, really. I don't think I would have really thought on those terms a few years back, but these days it's sort of, because I play a lot acoustically anyway, so I sometimes have to do that with my own songs anyway.
So any chance of the supergroup happening still with Blue Tones and Dodgy? I mean, it sounds an interesting project. Is it dead in the water or can it be revived?
I'll never say never, really. We'll see. I mean, everyone's really busy with a thing.
Yeah.
I've got my album, which is going to be hopefully finished at the end of March, and then I'll be hopefully releasing it soon after that. Mm. So this 25 years of this anniversary acoustic tour is going on till the end of May. And then I'll be doing the second, the follow-up to the Rookery, which had taken 10 years, but I've finally got it. And then I'm doing that. I'm working with Nigel still. Love writing with Nigel. He's great. Mm. He was one of my heroes back in the day. I remember Dodgy were one of the first proper bands that came into Fibbers. Yes. And we've been playing him on the jukebox, staying out for the summer and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
When Three Piece Suite came out, I just thought that album was mind-blowing. Yeah. And I still do, actually. It still makes the hairs on the back of my neck prick up.
Yeah.
And it's really nice that Nigel likes what I'm doing and I like what he does. And I'm supporting them on their tour, actually, in May,
right.
Which will continue on, I think, throughout the year.
Because
it's 20, I think it's 25 years of Three Piece Suite.
It is. Yeah. So, Graham, please do the summary for the evening. Maybe a last question and an appreciation for Chris spending the evening with us.
Well, first of all, I was going to say thank you, Chris, for giving us your time and being so honest
nice
as
to
well.
See you both again. It's been too long.
It's great to see you well and doing so well. And to finish on a slight tangent, now that the days of the original Fibbers venue in York are long gone, when I was there at the time, I used to think the place was sort of messy, chaotic, rumbustious, slightly annoying place to be, where Tim Hornsby, the owner, would throw people out one after another, day after day. And looking back on it, first of all, it was a glorious place to be. It was completely organic, and that organic, natural, open, liberal, and creative. And secondly, I don't think the way the Seahorses happened in terms of you and Stu getting that gig would have happened without that Fibbers environment that you're both involved with.
Mm. I think you're probably right. I mean, everything is an ingredient, isn't it, to end up with an end result. And I think that was a vital one, the whole Fibbers community. I mean, I worked there for 2 or 3 years anyway. Mm. And Tim was always very supportive with me after Chutzpah, making me, he used to just get me support slots for people and like John Martin and things like that. And I definitely wasn't prepared, but he threw me in at the deep end.
Mm.
And I was like, I can't do this. And I remember giving the John Martin gig to Dave Keegan but Tim was really quite brutal, but really, he definitely had a lot of faith in me. And I thought, and hopefully he still does, but Tim's, he's got a lot to answer for and mostly good things. So, and I do think that he created an absolutely brilliant little, almost as kind of crappy as CBGB's, but
yeah,
it definitely made me focus on what I should be doing and also kind of standard as well, really. But also saw me a different side of the business as well, from a promoter's angle and everything as well. But I think he's going to be writing his memoirs soon.
He is busily writing them as we speak. He's doing exactly that. Yes.
Yeah, that'll be fascinating, Reed, because, I mean, so many people went through that venue. He's got a lot of stories, and he can tell a good story as well.
He can.
Yeah.
Well, Chris, I say good night. Graham says good night. And enjoy Pocklington on Friday. And will you be including York gigs as well on this mighty, iconic tour?
No, I don't think so. I always save York for doing an album launch, but I say, it's been 10 years since.
Exactly.
I tend to not do that. I think it would be weird doing a Seahorses thing in York.
It would. You're right.
I don't think something, I don't know what it is, but I'm definitely not compelled to do it in any way.
Well, there you are. There's the honest reasoning, and we thank you for that.
No problem.
But Pocklington rocks on Saturday night, so enjoy that. And thank you for tonight. Cheers, then.
Hey, Chris. No problem at all, and it's great seeing you both again.
You've been listening to the podcast Two Big Egos in a Small Car. Your hosts were Graham Chalmers and Charles Hutchinson. This was a Baltic Sub production.